and there could be no justification for not killing him while they still had the chance. The tension over, Tungdil lowered his guard and gave in to his grief, mourning the loss of his adopted family and friends. Tears rolled down his cheeks, coursing through his beard, and he wiped them away with Frala's scarf. She had given him the talisman for luck, but now it was all he had left to remember her by.
"I won't let your deaths go unpunished," he promised his oldest friend.
Just then, a familiar stench rose to his nostrils. Tungdil looked up and exchanged glances with the twins. They too had smelled the rancid butter, which could only mean one thing. Orcs. He picked up his axe and rose to his feet.
"Let's see if I can remember those lessons."
They strode grimly to the door. Beroween's folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, late summer, 6234th solar cycle. Rumor had it that the High King was on his deathbed. In fact, according to some reports, Vrakas had smitten him already, and he had taken his place in the Eternal Smithy. There was no need to look far to find the source of the gossip. So eager were the Fourthlings to see their own king on the marble throne that they were only too happy to spread tidings of Gundrabur's demise. Come what may, they were determined to have their war against Alandur, whether the elves were guilty of treachery or not. At every discussion, no matter how big or small, Bislapur was there, tirelessly kindling the rumors, his every waking moment devoted to fanning the fires of his destructive campaign. No one seemed to need less sleep than Gandagar's devious advisor, except perhaps Belindi Lin, whom he regarded as a personal enemy.
"If only Vrakas would hurry up and smite the High King with his hammer," muttered Bislapur on returning to the chamber where he was staying as the Secondling's guest.
He lowered himself crossly onto his bed.
"I'm not making any progress."
Some of the Fourthling delegates were starting to doubt the wisdom of going to war.
"That blasted Belindi Lin is ruining everything. The sooner I take care of him, the..."
"Master, I bring news for you,"
a reedy voice announced from under his bed.
"Not that I choose to tell you anything. In fact, I didn't want to come at all."
Bislapur stood up and kicked the bedpost.
"Come out from there, you wretched gnome!"
Svert had barely emerged from his hiding place when Bislapur's calloused hand closed round his neck and lifted him into the air. He shook the gnome vigorously, like a cat would stun its prey, then tossed him roughly into the corner.
"You're not to sneak into my chamber without my permission, do you understand?"
Svert rose groggily and straightened his red jacket.
"I wasn't sneaking, master. You weren't here, so I hid in a place where no one would find me, like you said."
He tugged his hemp shirt over his rounded belly, covering his hairy green skin. His pointed ears stuck upward, as if pinning his cap to his head. There were few of his kind left in Girdlegard.
"Shall I tell you the news, master?"
asked Sverd, his large round eyes filled with mock innocence. Streaks of mud and dirt covered his saggy breeches and his buckled shoes. He had tramped for many miles.
"And if I do, will you let me go?"
"You'll go when I've finished with you."
Bislapur rested his hand threateningly on the magical silver wire that allowed him to tighten Sverd's collar from any distance.
"Talk, or I'll strangle you."
"I wish I'd never tried to steal your hoard,"
the gnome whined piteously.
"I regret it, really I do."
He looked at the dwarf expectantly, hoping to see a flicker of pity in the stony face.
"No wonder your kind is dying out if they're all as weak and pathetic as you."
Gandagar's advisor stayed as cold and unbending as the many valuable trinkets that he wore. He tugged on the wire, tightening the leather band around the neck of his slave. Sverd struggled to loosen the magic collar, but with no more success than at any other time during his 43 cycles of bondage. The choker contracted, and he sank to his knees, wheezing and panting. Bislapur waited until he was almost unconscious before slackening the leash.
"Thank you, master, thank you,"
the gnome coughed.
"Another joyous orbit at your side. How can I repay you?"
He sank onto a stool.
"Your pernicious plan failed. By all reports, the heir to the throne is still alive. Sadly, the same can't be said for our bounty hunters. There were no other takers for your cowardly mission, and I didn't have time to start a proper search. Girdlegard is changing.
Bislipur took no notice of his reluctant henchman's sneers. From the beginning of his enslavement, Sverd had been trying to provoke him into killing him, but Bislipur chose to ignore him. The gnome deserved to suffer.
What happened?
I trailed the dwarf and the secondlings to Lothionen's vaults. They were attacked by orcs.
Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Girdlegard, late summer, 6,234th solar cycle. The beast's approach could be heard from 100 paces. Suddenly the clunking of their armor was interrupted by a clamor of snarls and grunts. The orcs had discovered the lifeless revenant. On rounding a bend in the passageway, the three dwarves found themselves face to face with their foes. The exit to the vaults lay fewer than 300 paces ahead, but it seemed to Tungdil that every inch of that distance was filled with orcs. A bristling thicket of weaponry blocked their escape.
What fun!
Enthused Ironheart, squaring his shoulders.
See how narrow the tunnel is? We'll have the pleasure of killing every last runt.
He whirled his axes energetically.
Oink, oink! By the hammer of Vrakas, this is excellent sport!
The three of us will fight in formation, his brother told Tungdil soberly. I know you've never done this before, but stand back to back with us and make sure you can feel us behind you. That way, we'll all be safe.
His brown eyes sought Tungdil's.
Trust us to watch your back, and we'll trust you. You're a child of the smith, remember?
Tungdil took up position, wedging his back against the twins.
Trust in the others, he reminded himself, his heart thumping wildly. Stand by me, Vrakas.
He swallowed and forgot about his fear.
For Lothionen, Frala, and Girdlegard.
No more talking now,
Ironheart snapped at them, his eyes flashing wildly.
We've got skulls to cleave and shins to splinter.
As the twins commenced their dance of death, Tungdil did his best to keep pace with them, nearly tripping over himself in his eagerness not to ruin their guard. During the first few rotations, Tungdil could still see most of his surroundings. He glimpsed leering orc faces, saw green-hided flesh encased in various types of armor, spotted pillars among the jumble of legs, and occasionally sighted a whirling black plat. But soon they were moving so fast that it all became a blur. Swords, daggers, and cudgels swooped toward him, and he focused on dodging or parrying the blows. From time to time his axe met with resistance, and after a while his blade was coated in glistening green, leading him to suppose that some of his blows had struck true. It was the same basic strategy that the twins had used in the Eternal Forest. Back to back, the dwarves spun onward, boring their way through the enemy ranks, striking out furiously and never stopping for an instant, making it impossible for the beasts to land a proper blow. Tungdil was glad of his chainmail. He lacked the secondling's experience and was unable to field every strike, but his metal tunic protected him from the worst of it. He was willing to endure bruises, grazes, and even broken bones if it meant staying alive and saving the artifacts from Nodon's fleshy hands. He could hear Boindil laughing behind him, his frenzied cackles competing with the orc's dying shrieks. Boendar was far less vocal, preferring to conserve his breath. After a while, the strain was beginning to tell on Tungdil's arms, but the battle was far from over. In addition to the orcs in front of them, there was also the problem of the survivors, who were attacking from behind. In his despair, Tungdil came up with an alternative solution.
The struts!
He yelled, straining to lift his voice above the jangling steel.
Cut down the struts! Good thinking, scholar!
Boendar checked a blow, then rammed the offender with the butt of his crow's beak. A few moments later, his weapon powered into a wooden pillar. The force of the blow sent a strut crashing to the floor, followed by a shower of stone and dirt. The three dwarves repeated the maneuver until the unsupported ceiling collapsed behind them. Teon's minions disappeared under an avalanche of debris, as ton after ton of rock blocked the tunnel, securing their rear. The surviving orcs ran for the exit, afraid of being buried alive. Ironheart chased after them, swinging his axes furiously and felling all in his path. He stopped just short of the exit and waited for his companions.
Come on,
he urged them breathlessly.
There's another 20 of these runts waiting outside. It would be a shame not to kill them.
They closed ranks again. For all his hatred of orcs, Tungdil secretly hoped that the surviving beasts had seized their chance and fled. His weary arms were reluctant to lift much higher than his belt. Spinning in formation, they whirled out of the tunnel and into the darkness outside. The stars cast a silvery shimmer over the waiting orcs. 100 pairs of green eyes glinted menacingly in the moonlight. The beasts were growling and snarling under their breath.
I thought you said 20,
Tungdil muttered accusingly, his heart quailing at the sight.
Like I told you, some challenges are bigger than others,
Boindil assured him, glossing over his mistake.
This is one of the bigger ones.
Should we go right or left?
Asked Tungdil, who was keen to establish their strategy.
Straight through the middle. If they start slaying one another by accident, we'll have a better chance of making it unscathed. I'll deal with the chieftain, and when we're out the other side, we'll attack the flanks and hew down the rest.
Tungdil is new to this, remember?
His brother put in.
The High King told us to bring him back to Ogre's death, not to purge the countryside of runts.
Tungdil was profoundly relieved. He hadn't wanted to say anything for fear of disappointing the twins, but Boendar was less reckless than his brother, and his sharp eyes had noted his exhaustion.
Oh, all right then,
conceded Boindil, a little indignantly.
We'll go straight through the middle and forget about the flanks.
The plan established, they decided to act, not wanting to give the orcish archers an opportunity to use their bows. At first, their tactic worked perfectly, and they were mowing their way toward freedom at a tremendous rate when the enemy received unexpected support. The ranks thinned around them as the orcs backed away, clearing a path.
Hey, come back here, you pug-faced monsters!
Bellowed Ironheart, venting his frustration at the retreating beasts.
I'm not finished with you yet!
The orcs continued to back away from them, and a lone man stepped forward instead. Tungdil knew the bloated figure from the apparition that had conversed with the Famulus. The dark green robes, cloaking the swollen body, belonged to Lotionen's killer. The wizard looked doubly repulsive in the flesh. Blood trickled down his cheeks, and his skin hung in flabby folds, occluding his features. He smelled as if he had been rolling in a pile of rotting rubbish.
You've done well to get this far, but enough is enough, he purred.
Fixing his gaze on Tungdil, he extended a bloated hand.
Give me the artifacts and the books you stole from Greenglade. After that, you can go.
Tungdil gripped his axe stubbornly.
These items belong to my master, and I'll be damned if I'm giving them to you.
Nodon chuckled.
How terribly valiant of you.
He took a step toward them.
The artifacts belong to me. I'm in no mood for a discussion.
The end of his staff struck the ground, and he leveled the onyx-encrusted tip at Tungdil. No sooner had he done so than the knapsack and the leather bag jerked away from Tungdil, struggling against him and trying to wrest themselves from his grip. He hung onto the straps as best he could, but his efforts were no match for the wizard's sorcery. The leather ripped and slipped from his fingers. He brought his foot down on one of the drawstrings just in time.
I'll destroy the pouch and everything in it,
he threatened, raising his axe.
Be my guest. It would save me some work.
Nodon held his right arm on high, splayed his fingers, then clenched them into a fist. The bags left the ground with such force that Tungdil could do nothing to stop them. Their flight ended when they dropped into the arms of an enormous orc, who clutched them to his chest with a grunt. The magus was seized by a coughing fit. Blood leaked from his nostrils, and he wiped it hastily away.
Go back to your kingdom, dwarves, and tell your ruler that I require his land. He can give it to me willingly, or my allies will take it by force. The choice is his.
He gestured in Tungdil's direction.
Take him with you. I don't need him.
The two brothers said nothing. Gripping their weapons with steely determination, they were biding their time for an opportunity to attack. When the requisite diversion presented itself, they would hurl themselves on Nodon and cut him to ribbons. but it was no good attacking while they were under the surveillance of the wizard and his hordes. Suddenly there was confusion in the ranks. Beasts were pushing and shoving, and angry words were exchanged. Then a particularly strapping specimen drew his sword against his neighbor, and snarling furiously, buried it up to the hilt in his gut. Within the space of a few heartbeats, the orcs were slaughtering one another. Ironheart squared his shoulders, a sure sign that he was preparing to attack. His brown eyes were fixed on Nodon's knees.
"Tungdil, you chop up his staff,"
he ordered in dwarfish.
"The Fassor won't stand a chance against the three of us."
As always, he showed not a flicker of self-doubt.
"Ordinary weapons won't harm him."
Tungdil glanced out of the corner of his eye at the iron-clad beast who was guarding the knapsack and the artifacts.
"Our priority is to get the bags. Nodon seems determined to destroy them, so they're obviously important."
Ironheart nodded.
"You know what to do, Tungdil. On my signal."
The dwarves were preparing to leap into action when someone got there first. From the crest of a nearby hill, a bolt of lightning flashed toward the Magus and struck him in the side. Gasping, he dropped his staff and crumpled to the right. The next bolt sped toward the orcs, reducing 10 of their number to charred metal and flesh. The remaining beasts snarled in confusion, looking for the source of the attack. Spotting the figure at the top of the hill, they closed ranks and charged. Nodon raised his head and stretched out his right palm. The staff sprang into the air and flew into his hand. This was the opportunity that the dwarves had been waiting for. Shrieking, Ironheart bore down on him, planting his axes into his legs, while Boendar swung his crow's beak above his head and rammed it into Nodon's broad back. He raked the blade upward, and the Magus slumped to the ground. The wizard's orcish protectors were too distracted by the arrival of the powerful new adversary to notice his plight. As they raced up the hill, black clouds formed above them, and a roll of thunder announced the coming storm. The first orcs were paces away from their target when the tempest was unleashed. Lightning crackled to the earth, striking the front line of orcs and splitting their skins like sausages in boiling water. The dazzling flashes blinded those farther back, and the assault on the summit faltered and stopped altogether. A wind whipped up, raging among the beasts and knocking them over like skittles. Pitching into one another, the orcs were hurled against trees or dragged to their deaths by the gusts. Meanwhile, Boendal had skewered the Magus on his crow's beak and was pinning him to the ground. Ironheart leapt to his brother's aid, raining 4 fearsome blows on the Magus's neck and cleaving his vertebrae. Nodon's head rolled across the grass, and foul-smelling black blood spilled from the gushing stump. Ironheart opened his breeches and was about to sprinkle the corpse with dwarven water, but was stopped by his brother.
"The artifacts!"
Boendar reminded him sternly, pulling him away. A moment earlier, Tungdil had summoned his remaining strength for an all-out assault on the orc who was guarding his bags. He let his instinct, combined with his recently acquired knowledge, guide his axe. The beast fell sooner than he expected, the speed of his victory taking him by surprise.
"I can hold my own without the twins," he thought, gratified, quickly grabbing the bags.
Boendar ran up, his plait swinging vigorously as if it were alive.
"We did it! Gudlegard is free of the traitor!"
They hurried off, with Tungdil and Boendal in the lead and Ironheart covering their backs.
"It was child's play,"
he boasted, taking the opportunity to slay another couple of orcs.
"We showed the traitor who's..."
Ironheart's eyes shifted sideways, and he let out a terrible howl of rage.
"By the beard of Beroin, I thought we'd..."
Nodon was rising to his feet. His headless body straightened, and he stretched out a hand, beckoning to his skull, which flew toward him and settled on his severed neck. Not a scar remained to show where Ironheart's axes had raged. The Magus seemed as strong and alert as ever. He ordered the remaining orcs to deal with Tungdil and his companions, then turned to the hill to destroy his magical foe.
"Seize the artifacts and the books," he boomed through the darkness, "and kill the dwarves!"
The onyx on the end of his staff throbbed with light as he raised his hand toward the knoll. The ground quaked, a deep furrow opening in the earth and burrowing toward the figure on the hill. Bolts of lightning shot from the dark clouds, only to melt harmlessly into the protective shield that cocooned Nodon's body.
I knew it! Ordinary weapons can't harm him!
Tungdil grabbed his companions.
This way! He panted. The path leads south!
The trio raced off, slipping into a ditch to throw off their pursuers. They listened to the heavy trample of boots as the orcs charged past without seeing them.
We should have stood our ground,
Boindil whispered crossly.
I'm being killed!
Tungdil pushed himself deeper into the warm soil of the trench.
Didn't you see what he did back there? He got up even though you beheaded him. It proves he's more powerful than the Perished Land.
He pointed to the leather pouch that they'd managed to salvage.
The key to his destruction is in that bag.
You're the scholar,
Boindil told him.
Find a way of killing him and leave the rest to us. It's time we got back to Ogre's death. Our kingdoms are in danger, and we need to warn the assembly of Nodon's plans. You might be the only one who can stop him.
I don't know about that.
Tungdil's hopes were centered on their mysterious rescuer, who had fought magic with magic, thereby saving their lives.
Please, Vrakas, let it be Lotionen,
he prayed, unable to fight his tiredness any longer, as he drifted off to sleep.
Beroween's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Late Summer, 6234th Solar Cycle.
And I was following them into the woods when they suddenly disappeared,
said the gnome in conclusion. He tugged at the leather collar that had left him with a weal around his throat.
I had to get out of there quickly because the orcs were on my tail.
Bislapur was already deep in thought. Sverd's news obliged him to rethink his plans.
They're on their way here, then,
he muttered to himself.
Who, the orcs or the dwarves?
When Bislapur didn't answer, Sverd tried another tack.
You're not going to keep the news to yourself, are you? Didn't you hear what I said? The Magus wants to attack the dwarven kingdoms. Only a real scoundrel would...
Bislapur limped to the door.
Wait here, he ordered. Don't show yourself unless I tell you.
Yes, cruel master.
With a sigh, the gnome settled on a stool, his short legs dangling above the floor.
Bislapur rapped on Gandagar's door.
It's me, he shouted. Put on your cloak. We've got business to attend to.
Gandagar stepped out into the corridor and gave his advisor a bewildered look.
Wouldn't you rather come inside?
The exercise will do us good. Besides, there's enough gossip about me already. Apparently, I spend my time behind closed doors, plotting against the High King.
He snorted derisively.
They're welcome to see us talking, if that's what they want.
Gandagar threw a light cloak over his mail and followed Bislapur through the stone labyrinth that was Ogre's death. All around them were carvings and ornaments. The secondlings had sculpted great artworks out of the humble stone, but the masonry was all the more striking because of its lack of pretension. Gandagar marveled at its simple beauty, but his reverie was cut short.
I was just saying, Bislapur repeated softly, that everything will be ruined if they keep us waiting any longer. The High King is an obstinate fool.
Then what do you suggest?
I've consulted with the other chieftains. They think we should defeat the elves before the Perished Land gets there first.
At last he had Gandagar's attention.
Then let the Perished Land defeat them. It would solve the problem for us.
Actually, Your Majesty, it would make our task harder. Remember what the Perished Land does to the fallen. They rise again. Our warriors would never prevail against an army of undead elves. The Perished Land is immensely powerful, remember.
Bislapur's mail clunked slightly as he limped beside the king.
And what if the elves were to flee the threat and ensconce themselves somewhere quite unreachable? Their crimes against the dwarves would go unpunished, and your father and brother would never be avenged.
Despite the urgency in his voice, Bislapur was careful to speak softly. Anyone who saw them talking would assume they were preparing for the coming assembly, which was exactly what he intended.
It's time you were made High King and led the folks against Alandur. The Perished Land has lain dormant for some time. If it stirs, we must be back in our stronghold so we can wait in safety until the trouble has passed.
You heard what Gundrabur said, the Fourthling Sovereign reminded him. The laws were written by our forefathers. and I can't and won't defy them."
Their path led them to a beautiful sunlit valley, whose verdant slopes were dotted with sheep and goats. Rocky peaks towered on either side, with clouds stacked above them. To Gandagar, it seemed as if the mountains had impaled the bad weather on their summits to clear the skies for the pastures below.
"How peaceful it is here,"
he sighed, lowering himself onto a boulder.
"I wish our assemblies were as harmonious as this."
Bislipur's cold eyes scanned the grassy slopes.
"If you ask me, the other dwarves are exactly like sheep. They flock together, bleat until they get their food and beer, then fall into a self-satisfied slumber."
He laid a hand on the monarch's shoulder.
"You're a true king, Your Majesty, and you shouldn't be made to wait while some guttersnipe of a dwarf strolls across Girdlegard to challenge what's yours. Force a decision, and the delegates will support you. I'll make sure of it."
"You're asking a great deal, Bislipur."
The king rose, and they strolled back to the tunnel that led into the mountain and deep inside the Blue Range. At length, they came to a series of stone bridges, whose backbones arched over dark, fathomless chasms. These were the ancient mineshafts, now empty and abandoned. The Secondlings had plundered the mountain's riches and left deep gashes in its flesh. Bislipur walked in silence, allowing the king to reflect.
"But what of the laws?"
muttered Gandagar, turning the matter over in his mind.
"I can't force another vote without challenging the laws of our forefathers and defying the High King's decision."
"It would take courage, the courage to do what's best for our race. You need to act now, Your Majesty. You've never been afraid to take a stand."
The passageway led over one of the kingdom's many quarries, where sheets of smooth marble were being hewn from the rock. A river meandered peacefully to the right of the stoneworks. The king and his adviser stopped on a bridge 180 paces above the labourers and gazed at the bustle below.
"Undrabur might die at any moment," said Bislipur, still pressing for a decision.
"Surely you don't mean to make us wait until the stranger arrives and the hustings have been held? What if the Perish Land attacks while the throne is vacant? Without a high king, there'd be no one to organize our defenses and lead us to victory. The folks would squabble among themselves, and our race would be destroyed."
Gandagar pretended to ignore him, but the speech resonated with his own deliberations. He had been pondering the same questions, although he was still no closer to deciding what to do.
"The laws come from Vrakas, but should we stick to them slavishly? What if it means forfeiting opportunities and exposing ourselves to danger?"
He gave up and focused on the laborers below. They were working with incredible care and precision, handling the stone with as much consideration as if it were alive. Each sheet of marble was measured painstakingly before being prized from the mountain with pickaxes, crowbars, hammers, and chisels. Watermills powered the blades of the enormous saws. Dust hung in the air like grey mist, and the laborers wore cloths to protect their mouths and noses. A thick layer of powdered stone covered any piece of equipment not in regular use. It made Gandagar proud to think that he would soon be king of the dwarven folks. The children of Vrakas had their differences, but they were dwarves, united by ancestry, heritage, and a common foe.
"Should we suffer because of our laws?"
He pictured the faces of his father and brother who had been felled by elvish arrows.
"They were killed in cold blood."
His fists clenched, and his face darkened. He had made up his mind.
"Very well, Bislipur, we shall act. I am the one who is destined to unite the children of Vrakas, and what better way of strengthening the bonds between our kingdoms than a joint campaign against the elves? Victory over our enemies will pave the way for a new united future, and put an end to this feuding and quarrelling.
And your name will be linked forever with the start of a glorious era,"
Bislipur added approvingly, relieved that his constant sermonizing had eventually paid off.
"We've wasted enough time already. I shall tell Gundrabur that he has 30 orbits to hold a vote in which my succession will be confirmed."
"And if he dies before then? He's old and infirm."
"Then I'll be crowned, whether the mountebank has got here or not. Let's go back. I'm tired and hungry."
Privately, Bislipur was already working on his next assignment, unwittingly conferred on him by the king.
"A great deal can happen in 30 orbits,"
he thought grimly. Murder was not the worst of his crimes, and a little more skullduggery would be neither here nor there. But this time he needed to do everything right.
"Coming, Your Majesty," he replied.
Leaning over the parapet, he peered into the open quarry.
Anyone who had the misfortune to plummet from such a height would never be seen again.
He had just the assignment for Sverd. Enchanted Realm of Ionandar, Gerdlegard, late summer, 6,234th solar cycle.
"Come on, scholar, time to get up,"
a voice whispered in his ear. A wiry beard scratched his throat, and he was roused from his carefree dreams. Boendal and Boindil were peering out of the ditch, scanning the woods for roaming orcs. But the beasts had continued their search elsewhere. Tungdil and the others were free to head south toward the Secondling Kingdom.
What a mess, he thought glumly.
Things had turned out worse than he could have imagined. His errand had seemed simple enough, but now he was caught up in a succession crisis, and everyone he had known and loved was dead, leaving him and his two companions to flee for their lives across Gerdlegard, while a crazed Magus waged war on their kingdoms and tried to steal his bags.
"And I don't even know what's inside them."
Tungdil pulled the twigs and foliage out of his hair and beard. He was still fretting over Nudin's threat. The Magus had declared war on all Gerdlegard, men and elves included, and was planning to do battle with the dwarves.
"You look as though something's bothering you,"
said Boindil, handing him some bread and cheese. He pointed to the woods.
"Come on, you can eat on the way."
Tungdil fell in behind them.
"Warning the Dwarven Kingdoms is a big risk. Nadine wouldn't mention the invasion unless he thought he could win."
Boindil snorted.
"Ha! That was before we chopped off his head." "Not that it had much effect," his brother reminded him gravely. "What did you make of it, scholar? Is it normal for Magi to survive a mortal wound?"
Tungdil shook his head.
"Wizards are just ordinary humans. They live a little longer than most, but they're susceptible to injury like everyone else. Lot Ionan once cut himself on a knife and wove a spell to heal the skin. I asked whether his magic could counteract death, but..."
He pictured Lot Ionan and Frala and was too choked to continue. His companions didn't press him.
"Magi don't have the power to thwart death," he said finally. "Nadon was definitely dead," Boendal told him. "He had my crow's beak buried in his back, and his ugly mug was rolling on the ground. Maybe it's something that only dark wizards can do."
"If you ask me," said Boindil, "it's a special kind of jiggery-pokery taught to him by the perished land."
Tungdil didn't know what to make of it all. Seeing the Magus recover from his beheading had put pay to any theories about him being a revenant, leaving the dire possibility that Nudin had discovered the secret of eternal life. In which case, Gerdlegard was doomed.
"We should have chopped him into tiny pieces and burned the lot," growled Boindil.
"It wouldn't have worked," said a voice from the trees. The clear tones rang through the forest. "No known weapon can harm him. Swords, axes, magic. Nothing will kill him. I tried and failed." The trio whipped out their axes, and Ironheart wheeled round to cover their rear.
"It can't be an orc,"
Boendal whispered to Tungdil.
"Maybe, maybe not," said his brother. "I'm game for any kind of challenge, big or small."
The man who stepped out from among the pines drew a gasp of amazement from Tungdil. He had never imagined that a human could attain such dimensions. This one had a chest like a barrel and was as tall as two dwarves. Although Tungdil had seen pictures of suits of armor in Lot Ionan's books, nothing had prepared him for the sight of a real plated warrior. The man's breastplate, gorget, spaulders, and greaves were made of fine tionium and forged in such a way that the metal mimicked the curve of bulging muscle. The rings of a mail tunic, worn to give extra protection, were visible between the plates. A thin layer of cloth separated the segments of metal and dampened the clunking. Sabatons protected the warrior's huge feet, and his head was encased in a helmet. A demon's face stared out from the elaborately engraved visor, and a ring of finger-length spikes encircled his helm like a crown. In his left hand he held a shield, while in his right he gripped a double-bladed axe, the mighty weapon raised effortlessly as though it were made of mere wood.
A cudgel and a scabbard hung from his belt, the long blade resembling a dagger because of his great size. And as if this arsenal were not weighty and powerful enough, a two-handed sword was slung across his back. Bowindil glanced over his shoulder to see what was going on and was instantly transfixed by the colossus.
"Swap places with me," he begged his brother. "You cover our backs, and I'll bring down this mountain of metal."
His eyes flashed eagerly.
"That's what I call a big challenge. Better than a pack of runts." "Shush!"
Boendar silenced him sharply.
"Wait and see what he wants."
"His voice seems very high for a man of his size," said Tungdil, bewildered.
A blonde woman with a severe face and a long plait stepped out from behind the warrior.
"The voice wasn't his."
Her blue eyes pierced the trio. "It was mine." Tungdil appraised her commanding features and striking garb and wondered whether they had met before. She was athletic in appearance and wore black leather boots, gloves, and a tunic of dark brown leather, slit at the sides to give maximum movement. Her right hand rested on the pommel of her sword. There was something about her that reminded Tungdil of a woman that Lot Ionan had once described.
"Are you Andukai the Tempestuous?"
he ventured at last. The Maegar nodded. "And you need no introduction. Tungdil and his two friends who cheated Nodon's wrath." She pointed to the warrior who was standing motionless beside her, like a sculpted god of war. He was 5 heads taller than her. "This is Jerun, a loyal ally." Boendal eyed her suspiciously.
"What do you want?"
Tungdil took over quickly.
"What's happened to Lot Ionan? Is he alive?"
Andukai looked at him with angry, tortured eyes. "Lot Ionan is dead. And so are Myra, Tagur, and Sabora. They're all dead. Nodon didn't want them to interfere with his plans, so he killed them." Tungdil bowed his head. It hurt to have the truth confirmed. The pain of losing his foster father gnawed away at him, leaving a void inside.
"Our senior Famuli met a similar fate. Nodon was careful to ensure that none survived who could challenge his power," she continued grimly.
"Then it was you who cast lightning at him," Boindil said excitedly. "I hope you caused more damage than we did."
"He survived. I did everything in my power to kill him, but it was useless. As soon as I saw him recover from your attack, I feared the worst, and I was right. We can't do anything to stop him."
"Wretched Longins," Boendar muttered crankily. "We dwarves tear our beards out, patrolling the ranges and fighting Teon's hordes. And what do the humans do? Plot their own downfall. Vrakas should have made us into nannies, not warriors. Humans can't be trusted on their own."
"I'm afraid you're probably right."
Andukai took a step toward them.
"I came here because I wanted to ask you what Nodon was after."
She crouched in front of Tungdil.
"We were watching from the hillside. You must have something that he covets. What is it?"
Nothing really," he fibbed. "Just a few things that belonged to Lot Ionan. I kept them to remember him by, but Nodon wanted to destroy them. He and my Magus can't have been good friends."
"There was a time when they liked each other well enough." She smiled wryly. "Lot Ionan wasn't terribly fond of me." That triggered Tungdil's memory. As far as he could recall, Lot Ionan had disapproved of her values and her worship of Samusin.
"If the twins find out that she keeps orcs in her realm, things could turn nasty, and we're bound to come off worse."
Not only would the Maegar attack them with her wizardry, but her companion looked capable of snapping trees with his hands.
"To be honest," said Boindil,
who had decided not to beat around the bush,
"I don't much like you either. You go your way, and we'll go ours. We've problems enough of our own."
"Problems?"
Andukai said scornfully. She straightened up. "Your problems won't seem important when Nodon invades. The dwarven kingdoms will fare no better than the realms of men and elves. The Magus has allied himself with the perished land, and together they seek absolute unlimited power." Her chin jutted out, and she eyed Boindil with a look of contempt. "Run along and hide in your mountains. Teon's creatures will storm your strongholds from both sides."
"What do you propose to do?" asked Tungdil.
"We're leaving," she said frankly. "I'm not foolish enough to think that I could stop the perished land.
No army will be mighty enough to challenge Nodon, regardless of what the kings of men may think. What good would it do to stay? I'd only be condemned to become a revenant, a fate which, Samusin willing, I'm anxious to escape. She searched the dwarves' faces. And you? If you're headed for Ogre's death, we'd like to join you. Rest assured, we'll leave by way of the High Pass and never see you again. But we could journey as friends until then. The dwarves discussed the matter in private and decided to accept the proposal. Boindel's objections were overruled. The other two had learned from their encounter with Nodon and could see that the Maegor would be a useful ally when facing the dangers ahead. Boindel made a show of complaining, but fighting with words was not his strong point, and Tungdil argued him into a corner with his scholarly speech.
"Fine," sulked the secondling, "but don't say I didn't warn you."
Tungdil informed the pair of their decision.
"But remember, we're the ones in charge."
Boindel glared at the Maegor's companion contemptuously. He was obviously longing to pit his strength against the colossal warrior.
"Hey, what's wrong with your tongue? Maybe if you took that bucket off your head, you'd be able to speak."
"Jerun is mute," the Maegor rebuked him sharply. "Remember your manners, or I might have a thing or two to say about your height."
"My manners are my concern,"
huffed Boindel, smarting. He tossed his plait over his shoulder and turned back to the warrior.
"Take my advice and keep out of my way," he warned,
quickening his pace to lead the procession.
"I deal with the orcs, all right? No doubt you'll learn soon enough."
Tungdil fell into line behind Andukai, and they set off.
"I'll wait until this evening to find out more," he decided.
It would be easier to ask his questions without the twins listening in.
"Estimable Maegor, how did Lotionen die?"
Andukai had withdrawn a few paces from the fire and was sitting on her cloak, gazing into the flames. Instead of addressing her in dwarfish, Tungdil deliberately chose the language spoken by junior wizards. He wanted to demonstrate that he was educated and not a simple working dwarf. It had taken a while for him to summon the courage to sit down beside her and engage her in conversation. Back propped against a tree, Jerun was positioned nearby. The giant's weapons were arranged neatly on the grass in order of length, easily reachable with either hand. Owing to his visor, it was impossible to tell whether he was dozing.
"Lotionen schooled you well, it seems," she said slowly,
eyes still fixed on the flames. "An educated dwarf is a rarity in Gerdlegard." "Well, dwarves are rare enough." She paused.
"I could tell you how your Magus died, but the story of Nudine's treachery would only grieve us both. I want to know why Nudine changed."
"So do I, Tungdil." Andukai turned and looked at him bitterly.
"I don't suppose we'll ever find out."
She recounted what had happened in Perista that night.
"Nudine struck out at me without warning. He drew on his magic to deal me a blow that knocked me senseless. I didn't regain consciousness until later."
She paused, resting her chin on her hands.
"I cut him down with my sword, but he plunged his staff into my chest. After that I was too dazed to register anything but the sounds of the struggle."
The Maegor took a deep breath, stretched out her legs, and looked up at the stars.
"They must have fought him all the way. The sound of their screams will be with me forever. As for me, I could feel the blood seeping from my body, and there was nothing I could do."
"But you survived."
"Thanks to my bodyguard."
She glanced tenderly at the unmoving giant.
"Nodon must have forgotten that Jerun had accompanied me to the palace. As soon as the lunatic Magus had gone, he broke into the room and treated my wounds. I was too weak to confront the traitor, so Jerun stole a corpse from the morgue, dressed it in my clothes, and left it with the other bodies. We wanted Nodon to think he was safe."
She reached for a branch and tossed it into the fire, sending sparks crackling into the night sky.
"He is safe," she said dismally. "And Lotionen? What—"
"By the time Jerun found me, your Magus had been turned to stone. Nodon turned him into a statue." A tear of helpless rage trickled down her cheek.
"A statue,"
whispered the dwarf, drawing closer to the fire.
"Isn't there any way to—"
The Maegor shook her head, but said nothing. They sat in silence, their thoughts with the dead. Stars twinkled in the firmament, and long moments passed. "So you're leaving Girdlegard," Tungdil said wearily. "Where will you go? Aren't you worried about your realm?" He wiped the back of his hand across his face. He had been staring unblinkingly at the flickering flames, and the heat had dried his tears, leaving a salty residue in his eyes. "Will things be better elsewhere?" "I'd be a fool to throw myself in front of a rolling stone when there's nothing else to stop it," she said softly. "It's not in my nature to prolong suffering without good cause. I shall give up my realm without a fight. What good would come of resisting? I may as well take my chances across the border now that Girdlegard's defenses have fallen." It was clear from her tone that the matter was closed. "I need to sleep." After thanking the Maegar for her confidences, Tungdil withdrew and joined the twins to tell them what had happened in Leos Nudin.
"The wizards are really dead?"
Boindil skewered another piece of cheese from his seemingly endless supply.
"So much for their miraculous powers."
"The strongest shield is useless when the sword is wielded by a traitor," his brother said wisely, munching on a hunk of toasted bread. "The Longans are a wretched lot. I can't imagine what the gods were thinking when they created them."
He chewed his mouthful vigorously.
"It's bad enough that they kill each other without dragging the rest of us into it."
Tungdil reached for a helping of molten cheese and popped it into his mouth. He had developed a taste for the pungent delicacy, which he regarded as a sign of progress as far as his dwarven credentials were concerned. Boindil gave him a nudge and pointed his cheese skewer at the mismatched pair on the opposite side of the fire.
"Would you believe it? He's still wearing that bucket. I bet it's stuck on his head."
Boindil was more respectful.
"It's his height that gets me. Granted, I don't know much about humans, but he's by far the biggest Longan I've ever seen. He makes orcs look like children."
"What if he's not really a Longan?"
his brother said suspiciously.
"He could be a baby ogre, or Teon knows what."
Already he was on his feet, preparing to march over and confront the giant.
"I'm telling you, if there's a green-hided runt hiding in that armor, I'll kill it on the spot."
He grinned dangerously.
"The same goes for the lady. So what if she's a Maegar? She's not much use to Girdlegard now."
Tungdil's face flushed with panic. He wouldn't put it past Andukai to have one of Teon's monsters at her side.
"I can't let Boindil pick a fight with Jerun. If he starts on the giant, Andukai will join the fray and we'll all be in trouble."
"No, he's a man all right," he said firmly. "Haven't you heard about the human giants? I read somewhere that they join together in formidable armies. The orcs are scared stiff of them."
It was a nerve-wracking business lying to his kinsfolk, but he knew it was for the best.
"How do they get that big?"
persisted Boindil, reluctant to let the matter drop. He jiggled his axes, hoping to find some reason that would allow him to test his strength against the giant.
It's their mothers. You see, they...
Tungdil tried feverishly to dream up an explanation. Almost anything would do.
"Straight after birth, the mothers tie ropes to their arms and legs and stretch them as much as they can. They keep doing it every morning and every night," he blustered. "And it works, as you can see. They've got a fearsome reputation on the battlefield. They actually grow into their armor. They can't take it off."
The brothers looked at him incredulously.
"Their mothers really do that to them?"
Boindil was shocked.
"That's pretty gruesome, don't you think?"
"That's what it says in the books."
Boindil looked the warrior up and down.
"I'd like to know what he weighs and how much he can lift."
The three dwarves stared at the giant, trying to work out whether or not he was asleep. His demonic visor shone in the flames, grinning at them mockingly. Boindil shrugged.
"Sooner or later he'll show his face. He'll have to lift his visor when he eats."
Chapter 9. Kingdom of Gauragar, Girdlegard, late summer, 6,234th solar cycle. It had been a long time, perhaps thousands of cycles, since Girdlegard had last seen a band of travellers as strange as the company that had been toiling through Ionandar and Gauragar for several orbits. First to appear over the hilltop was Jerun, his formidable armoured body provoking horrified panic among any peasants who happened to be tending the land. The dwarves led the way, but their stocky figures took longer to loom into view. Boindil and Boindil walked ahead,
with Tungdil in the middle and Andokai and the giant a few paces behind. Jeroen was forced to take miniature strides in order not to outpace his mistress and the dwarves. The Magyar had offered a farmer a ridiculous number of gold coins to part with his horse, which now bore the weight of her bags and the giant's spare weaponry. Tungdil was still trying to work out whether to tell Andokai about the books. He had no idea what was written in the scholarly tomes, but it was encouraging to know that Nodon feared their contents as much as the artifacts.
"Who knows if I can stop him, but Andokai surely can. She's the last of Gerdlegard's Magi."
He was determined to do whatever it took to make her stay. Slowing his pace a little, he fell in beside her.
"I've been thinking about your magic, and I can't figure out why it still works. Didn't Nodon corrupt the force fields?"
"Why do you ask?"
"It's important."
"For you or for me?"
"For Gerdlegard."
"For Gerdlegard. Very well, Tungdil, how could I refuse?"
She smiled balefully.
"I was never as kind-spirited as my fellow Magi. My god is Samusin, god of equilibrium, who cherishes darkness as well as light. Thanks to him, I have the ability to use both. It's harder for me to store and use dark magic, but the corruption of the force fields hasn't really affected my powers. Nodon knows that, but he wasn't expecting me to survive. Not that he's got anything to worry about. My art is nothing compared to his."
Shielding her eyes with her hand, she squinted into the distance.
"There should be a forest ahead. I can't stand this sun much longer."
"You've got to ask her now,"
Tungdil told himself. He summoned all his courage.
"Magyar, suppose there was a way of stopping the traitor. Would you try it?"
he asked. There was silence. Just as the tension was becoming unbearable, Andokai spoke. "Would this have something to do with the contents of your bags, little man?"
"We found something in Greenglade," he told her,
giving a brief account of what had happened in the woods.
"Nodon sent in the Alpha, but we got there first."
"Are you going to show me?"
Tungdil thought for a moment and decided that there was no point leaving the matter half-solved. He slid the package out of his knapsack, removed the wrapping, and handed over the books. Andokai opened each of the tomes in turn and leafed through the pages, her face remaining an inscrutable mask. Tungdil couldn't help feeling disappointed. He had reckoned with her amazement. Seeing her dispassionate expression made him fear the worst. At length she returned the volumes.
"Was there anything with them?"
"What are they about?"
he asked, deciding not to give away anything until he'd found out more.
"They're anthologies, descriptions of legendary beings and mythical weapons, and an obscure tale about an expedition across the stone gateway into the outer lands. It says in the preface that a single survivor returned, mortally wounded, but bearing manuscripts that are reproduced in the book. Why Nodon should take an interest in the volumes is a mystery. I suppose he's just as knowledge-lusty as before."
"What else do they say?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing? Nodon wouldn't have sacked Greenglade for nothing. He had us chased by a war band of orcs just to get his hands on the books."
He glared at the Magyar defiantly.
"With respect, Magyar, I think you're wrong. There's something important in those volumes, even if you can't see it. Are you daring to—"
The mistress of Brandokai stopped and erupted into laughter.
"Did you hear that, Jeroen? Here I am, traipsing along a dusty road, being corrected by a dwarf who thinks he knows best."
The giant kept walking, impassive as ever.
"I didn't mean to cause offence," said Tungdil. "But at least I'm not as arrogant and sure of myself as you are. I shouldn't wonder if there's elfish blood in your veins."
"Fighting talk, little dwarf," she said in amusement. She nodded in the direction of the twins. "The other two would have drawn their weapons and settled the matter another way. But you learned from Lotionen, I can tell." Suddenly she was serious again.
"I'll take a proper look at the volumes tonight. Maybe you're right, and there's more to them than I thought."
"Thank you, estimable Magyar."
The dwarf inclined his head respectfully and quickened his pace to catch up with the twins.
"We'll soon find out what the Magus wanted with our books," he announced proudly. "What? You didn't tell the wizard women about them, did you?"
gasped a horrified Boindil.
"Not only that, I showed them to her."
The secondling shook his head reprovingly.
You're too trusting, scholar. It's time you became a proper dwarf and stopped acting like a human.
I see. So you'd like me to splice her skull if she disagrees with me, would you? Said Tungdil, his temper beginning to fray.
I'd like to see you dare,
Bowendal retorted with venom.
Bowendal quickly squeezed between them.
Stop it,
he said firmly.
Spare your fury for the orcs. I doubt we've seen the last of them. For what it's worth, I think Tungdil was right to tell the Maegar. I don't like being hounded because of a couple of books I know nothing about.
His brother just grunted and surged on.
I never said travelling with us would be easy,
Bowendal said with a grin. Tungdil sighed, then burst out laughing. Dusk was falling when they set up camp. The air had cooled, and there was a smell of earth and grass. A band of crickets was chirping its evening concert. The dwarves divided up their dwindling provisions. The sight of the Blue Range's summits in the distance reassured them that they would soon be feasting on fresh dwarven treats. Meanwhile, Andukai kept her word and studied the books. Not wanting to distract her, Tungdil allowed the Maegar to read in peace, approaching only to bring Jerun his supper. Like every other evening, he placed a loaf of bread, a chunk of cheese, and a large slab of meat beside the warrior. This time he was determined to keep an eye on the giant while he ate. So far, neither Tungdil nor the twins had seen behind the metal visor.
Jerun will sit the first watch, said Andukai, without looking up from her reading. The rest of you can get some sleep.
Suits me fine, said Bowindil, then burped.
He shook the worst of the crumbs from his beard, coiled his plait into a pillow, and settled down next to the fire.
Listen, Longin,
he told the giant, who was sitting motionless as usual.
Don't forget to wake me if you see any orcs. It's about time they had a taste of my axes.
The twins seized the chance to get some sleep, and in no time loud snores were reverberating through the woods, setting the leaves a-quiver. Andukai slammed down her book.
Now I know why they always take the first watch, she said irritably. It's a wonder their snores never woke me. How am I supposed to concentrate when they're making such a din?
Tungdil chuckled.
Imagine what it sounds like in Ogre's death.
I don't intend staying long enough to find out.
Tungdil looked at her rippling muscles as she stretched. She was impressively strong for a woman, stronger even than the scullery maids who were used to hard labor.
Have you found anything new in the...
Tungdil checked himself. He had resolved not to ask her about the books. Hugging her knees to her chest, she rested her chin on her hands and turned her blue eyes on him.
You think I'll change my mind if the books tell us how Nadon can be defeated?
Samusin is the god of equilibrium. Surely it's your duty to strive for a balance between darkness and light, he said,
appealing to her faith, since honor alone was not enough to persuade her. Her decision to abandon her realm was proof enough of that. Andukai laid a hand on one of the leather-bound volumes.
If I could find a spell or a charm that would cause Nadon's downfall, I would take the traitor on, she said earnestly. But the books contain nothing of the kind, just far-fetched stories and myths.
So you're turning your back on Gerdlegard?
My art is useless against Nadon's power. I was lucky to escape.
She flicked through the book, opening it at random.
Maybe there is some kind of hidden meaning. All I know is that I don't have the key.
Tungdil decided to come clean. He produced the letter that Gareen had written in scholarly script.
This was with the books. I suppose it might help.
Is there anything else you're not telling me, or is this the last of your secrets?
It's the last, I swear.
Andukai accepted the sheet of parchment, folded it, and placed it between the pages of one of the books. She rubbed her eyes.
The darkness is hardly conducive to study. I'll read it tomorrow.
She returned the volumes to their wax paper wrapping, arranged the parcel as a pillow, and nestled her head on top.
Tomorrow?
Tungdil had been expecting her to read the letter at once. He sighed. The Maegar was a troublesome person to deal with. He settled down next to the fire and glanced at Jerun. The giant was still wearing his helmet, but the food was gone. Tungdil cursed. Talking to Andukai had distracted him from looking at Jerun's visor, although, now that he thought about it, he hadn't been alerted by a telling clunk of metal. There was something unnerving about the Maegar's companion. Beroween's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, late summer, 6,234th solar cycle. Belendilin barely had a moment to himself. On reaching his chamber, he discovered that two dwarves from the Fourthling delegation had requested to see him.
"Not a moment too soon. It's about time Gandragar put a stop to this foolishness."
He turned round and hurried to the meadows, where the delegates were expecting him. The High King's counselor was feeling remarkably upbeat. For weeks he had poured most of his energy into rebutting the rumors about Gundrabur's failing health, and rightly so. The High King had a strong heart and an even stronger will, which he employed in persuading the assembly to await the arrival of the other pretender to the throne. Such was his success that there was talk of strengthening the bonds among the folks in more permanent ways.
"It's going almost too well," thought Belendilin, gripped by a sudden apprehension.
He stepped out of the passageway and onto a bridge across a chasm 50 paces wide. Deep in thought, he made his way over the disused copper mines 200 paces below. It bothered him that Bislapur never seemed to tire of rekindling the passions of those who favored a war against the elves. He and Gundrabur would have achieved much more if it hadn't been for the Fourthling's inflammatory speeches.
"He's a rabble-rouser. You can guarantee his influence is at the heart of Gandagar's misplaced zeal."
Just then, he noticed a movement in the mouth of the tunnel ahead. Bislapur was on the bridge in front of him, his left hand resting lightly on his axe. For a moment, Belendilin wondered whether the Fourthling could have heard his thoughts through the thick stone walls. There was something threatening about his demeanor. Belendilin stopped and waited.
"Were you looking for me?"
"Do you know what they're calling it?"
Bislapur shouted, his voice echoing against the rock.
"The Quarrel of the Cripples. One-armed Belendilin against Bislapur the Lame. Is that how you see it?"
Belendilin paused, hoping to hear sounds of other dwarves, but the tunnels were deserted. He and Bislapur were alone.
"Quarrel is too strong a word," he answered. "You have your convictions, I have mine, and we're both trying to persuade the assembly of our views."
He took a step forward, then another one. Bislapur did the same.
"What is it that you want?"
"To serve the dwarves," Bislapur said, grim-faced.
"What is it that you want from me?"
"A change of heart. How can I persuade you that the future of the folks and clans lies with Gandagar and me?"
"If you persist in campaigning for a war against the elves, I will never be able to support your king,"
Belendilin said frankly. He stood his ground, and Bislapur stopped too. 15 paces remained between them.
"Then a quarrel it is," Bislapur told him harshly. "Until Gandagar has been elected, I shall regard you as an enemy and a danger to the prosperity and safety of our race. The others will come round to my view."
He walked toward Belendilin, who was advancing along the bridge. Only an arm's length separated the two dwarves.
"It's about time the High King was spared your counsel, so he can come to his senses at last."
By now they were so close that their noses were almost touching.
"To his senses? That's rich from you."
Belendilin stared at Bislapur and saw implacable hatred and enmity in his eyes.
"Let me tell you this," he said, trying not to betray his fear,
even though Bislapur undoubtedly intended to harm him.
"Your war against Alandur will never happen. Even the Fourthling chieftains are having second thoughts." "The throne is ours. You're no match for Gandalgard and me."
The words were spat violently, Bislapur's pent-up fury ready to erupt at any moment.
"I didn't realize you were bidding for a joint succession."
Neither flinched as they glared at each other, eyes locked in combat. All of a sudden, Bislapur's air of menace fell away.
"Well, good luck with your lost cause," he said breezily. "May Vlachas be with you."
He stepped past Belendilin and continued along the bridge. The High King's counselor closed his eyes and swallowed. Having resigned himself to a duel, he could scarcely believe that he was going to make it across the chasm without a fight. Bislapur's whistling reverberated through the tunnel, the simple melody repeating itself and overlapping as he strode away. It was a relief to leave the bridge and feel solid ground beneath his feet.
At least I know he means business, thought Belendilin philosophically.
He pressed on, anxious not to keep the Fourthling delegates waiting. He was just approaching a bend in the passageway when the floor seemed to shake. The movement was so slight that a human would never have detected it, but the dwarves had learned to take notice of the faintest vibrations in the rock. Something heavy was heading his way. The next instant, he heard agitated mooing and thundering hooves. From what he could gather, a herd had been startled on its return from the meadows. Belendilin scanned his surroundings, searching in vain for a niche that would save him from the cattle's charge. There was no choice but to regain the bridge, climb over the parapet, and balance on the narrow ledge. He turned and sped back along the passageway, spurred on by the sound of horns scraping against the polished walls. Panting heavily, he reached the end of the tunnel, and the bridge came into view. The animals were right behind him. Without hesitating, he swung himself over the side and steadied himself on the ledge. The momentum nearly carried him into the abyss, but the daring maneuver paid off, and the cows streamed past behind him.
Vrakas be praised!
There was a jolt, and the bridge cracked audibly. He could see the first fissures running through the rock. It was only then that it occurred to him that the bridge was not designed to bear the weight of stampeding cows. It had been built for dwarves, not cattle. The herd exceeded its strength by a matter of tons, and the rhythmic pounding of their hooves had a devastating effect. The first crack opened at the midpoint of the bridge, where the stone was at its thinnest. The struts beneath it snapped, heralding the next stage in the disaster. A section of stone, measuring 4 paces in length, gave way, sending a number of cows plummeting into the abyss. From there, the destruction spread along the bridge. Slab by slab, the stone fell away, cows tumbling to their deaths, their moos becoming fainter and fainter. At the back of his mind, Belendilin was aware that there was still no sign that they had hit the bottom. His position was precarious in the extreme. With the bridge crumbling before his eyes, he was faced with a choice of dying among the cows or casting himself voluntarily into the abyss. At last, the herd stopped surging, and the dwarf summoned the courage to leap into their midst. Barely had his feet touched the ground when the stone gave way beneath him. Grabbing wildly at the edge, he managed to catch hold of a jagged overhang and clung on for dear life. An able-bodied dwarf would have hauled himself to safety easily, but Belendilin, dangling by his only arm, had no means of saving himself and no prospect of being rescued. He knew it was merely a matter of time before his muscles gave out.
"Is there anyone there?"